Hello and welcome to Light the Way with Dr. Colin Monger. He's the senior pastor of Shepherd of the Hills Church. At Light the Way, we believe the most powerful tool we possess when sharing our faith with others is the Word of God. It was the Apostle Paul that said, "Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of Christ." So as we open the Word together, it's our prayer that you'll not only receive what God has for you, but share what you learn with those you come in contact with. And now, here's Pastor Colin.
Well, if you brought your Bibles, would you turn with me to Matthew 5? Matthew 5. You know, it occurred to me that we've been in Matthew 5 for quite a while. In my Bible, Matthew 5 is like one page. So you could bring one page to church and you could still keep up with us. But we're in Matthew 5 today. You know, if you asked me to create for you a list of the most misunderstood emotions that we deal with, anger would always be at the top of it. And here's why. Because we all deal with anger. Every one of us has the emotion of anger, and it rears its ugly head from time to time. However, very few of us know exactly what to do with it, how to manage it, and what it means. And because of that, there's a lot of folks in the world who think that to be angry is wrong. And any time they get a little flustered at anything, they're instantly apologizing. "I'm sorry I got angry. I shouldn't have got angry." Well, the truth is, anger isn't a sin. There's people who think it is. It isn't a sin. It's an emotion. It's given by God. There are times in the Bible where God is angry at sin and at other things, but anger in and of itself isn't a sin. In Ephesians 4, it even tells us to be angry and sin not. And so the two are not naturally united, but they can become that way if we're not careful. Anger is nothing more than a feeling given by God, we'll call it that, that will tell us that something is that shouldn't be. It's like a little alarm that goes off in our life. Something has happened and it shouldn't have happened, and this is how we can identify it. And if it's used properly, it can lead to positive change in the world. For example, if a student fails a test and gets angry at that, they might study harder next time and get the grade that they're looking for. If an athlete loses a competition, they might get angry at the fact that they lost, and they would take action to train harder and next time win the game. I remember one time I was applying for a job, and I was very, practically speaking, qualified. I'd been doing that job. Our manager had left, and at the time, I'd been doing his job in the interim, and things were going fairly smoothly. And I applied for the job, and everybody just assumed I was going to get it. But then the owner of the company told me, "We're not going to hire you for it because you don't have a degree in business." And that angered me, and I said, "Well, never again will that happen." And so I went to school, and I got a degree in business. Anger can lead to positive change. It was Martin Luther who got angry at what the Roman Catholic Church was doing to the idea of God's grace, and he led the church in the Reformation. It was anger that led Martin Luther King to lead the civil rights movement. It was anger that led our founding fathers to declare independence from Great Britain. It was anger of sin and what it had done to God's creation that led God to promise in Genesis 3 that Jesus would come and save us all. And so anger doesn't have to always be a negative thing. It can be used properly and result in positive change. But if it's used improperly, if it's not checked, if it's not controlled, it can cause great pain in life. It's kind of like playing with fire. If you're not careful, you can get burned. And anger is very similar to that in life. If left unchecked, if uncontrolled, if used carelessly, it can affect your relationships, your personal life. It can bring hardship, even can cause legal issues, depending on how that anger shows up. That's why it says in James chapter 1, to be slow to anger. Don't let this be something we rush into, but rather something that we use carefully. There's a story of Winston Churchill from the 1940s. He was the Prime Minister of Great Britain during World War II, and the whole world kind of looked to Churchill for leadership during World War II. The Allied armies were based in England, and the invasion of Europe came from there, and so much happened in Great Britain that Churchill was really kind of thrust on the international scene, and a lot of people loved Churchill. But he did have his fair share of political opponents as well. There was one in particular. Her name was Lady Astor. And Lady Astor could not stand Winston Churchill. Now, they didn't have Facebook, but they did have a newspaper. And every week, she would take out some article just railing against Churchill. Well, one week, she took out an article and she said, "Mr. Churchill, if I were your wife, I'd poison your tea." Well, the next week, Winston Churchill responded in kind and took out his own article and said, "Lady Astor, if I were your husband, I would gladly drink it." And so their relationship went. Well, there was one time where both of them ended up at the same social function. And Winston Churchill was drinking a little bit and had become a little tipsy. Lady Astor noticed it and, not wanting to miss the opportunity, tried to embarrass him in front of everybody. And she said, "Mr. Churchill, you're drunk." And he said, "That may be, ma'am, and you're ugly. And in the morning, I'll be sober." It's funny, but it is a relationship historically that was consumed by anger toward one another. What angers you? What pushes your buttons? Gets under your skin? Everybody has something. Many of us, most of us, have more than one. But what's yours? And to follow up with that, what do you do when you get angry? Do you take a positive turn? Does it lead to positive change? Or do you get nasty and spiteful toward others? That's what I want to talk about this morning. Calming a turbulent heart. Because if anger isn't controlled by you, you can guarantee that you will be controlled by anger. And that's what Jesus talks about here. And he talks about what happens when that anger takes over a person's life. When it's left uncontrolled and unchecked and unmanaged and it's left to just do its own thing, what does it look like? I've asked you to open to Matthew 5. Notice what Jesus says about this, beginning in verse 21. "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment.'" You might hear that, and you might say, "Well, yeah, I've been angry at people, but I've never murdered anyone," and that might be true. But Jesus says that murder is nothing more than the physical manifestation of uncontrolled anger. If left to its natural devices, this is what it will evolve into. But it's also important to understand what he's talking about here. Notice he says, "You shall not murder." In the Ten Commandments, sometimes it's translated, "Thou shalt not kill," but a better rendition is, "Thou shalt not murder." It's not talking about all the killing that happens in the world. This is talking about murder. There are times in the Bible where killing is justified. For example, in self-defense or in the defense of a person's home, if you have an intruder and they're killed in certain conditions, it can be justified. In Exodus 22, it tells us, if a thief is caught breaking into a house at nighttime and they're killed by the owner, that the owner is not liable for the death. It's not talking about capital punishment. In Genesis 9, after the great flood, when the waters recede and God gives to Noah all the animals to eat for food, he says in Genesis 9, "Whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed." We have capital punishment in this nation, and not to get into the debate over whether we should or how often it's righteous, but rather just to simply say that the Bible affirms that that's not considered murder. In fact, in Matthew, Jesus affirms the very same thing. When Peter grabs the sword of Malchus, the temple guard in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he swings it and he cuts off his ear, Jesus knew that Peter wasn't trying to cut off that guy's ear. He wasn't very good at much, and he tried to cut off his head, and that was the feeling in his heart. And so Jesus goes to Peter and says, "Put it down, because if you live by the sword, you will die by the sword." There will be the same kind of punishment for people who live this lifestyle. Paul later affirms capital punishment. He says in Romans 13, "The government doesn't bear the sword in vain." And so self-defense isn't considered murder. Capital punishment isn't murder. Soldiers in wartime in Scripture is not considered murder in battle. David killed Goliath. He was empowered by the Lord to do it. Samson killed the Philistines and led Israel to victory over them and freedom from them. And Samson wasn't considered a murderer. And so Jesus isn't talking about justified killing. He's not talking about accidents either. Not talking about the time that, you know, two cars collide and nobody's really trying to do anything wrong. It's just an accident and it happens. That's not considered murder. Here, it literally speaks to the crime of homicide, the intentional, unlawful taking of a human life. And the truth about murder is it's as old as the hills and twice as dusty, they say. It's the oldest crime in the world. It was the first crime ever committed. After the fall, Cain kills his brother Abel and murders him in an open field. And ever since then, it's been a problem that we've dealt with as a society. And so there are laws against murder, and there always have been. And so Jesus says, you've heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder. The law says you can't murder people. And the truth is, without the law that says you can't murder people, more people statistically would. There was a study done one time that found one out of every four people surveyed admitted to either seriously being willing to consider or acting upon the impulse to kill someone if there was enough money to be paid. They'd kill for hire. In other words, one out of four people, if they wouldn't get caught and the money was good enough, they would take someone's life. In Chicago, to date, this very year, there have been more than 330 murders. In New York, it's been 213, in L.A., 108, and in the average year in America, we see 20,000 murders committed. And because the law puts a fear of a penalty from murder into the hearts of many people, more people don't. But statistically, 25% of our nation would if the payday was there and they wouldn't get caught. But the law says you can't murder. And there's penalties for murder. And so why is it so high even to begin with? Why do we have 20,000 murders a year? It's more than any other developed nation on earth. Some people will argue about that, and they say it's because there's guns and they're easily available, and there may be some truth in that. And there, other people say it's because of the breakdown of the family, and there may be some truth in that, or because of drugs, there may be some truth in that. Some people say murder is because of mental illness in America. Maybe there's some truth in that. But you know, no one ever talks about TV, video games for kids. I was reading another survey that said by the time they're 18 years old, the average child will have seen more than 200,000 violent acts on TV designed for children. We don't talk about that. We don't talk about the cartoons where they're killing each other or knocking each other off of a cliff. And it's funny and it's humorous and we've all seen it. But the reality is 200,000 times a child will be exposed to some act of murder on TV. But whatever the reason or the combination of reasons, murder happens. And so we have a law and the law deals with the act of murder. He was said to those of old, you shall not murder. And if you do, you'll be liable to judgment. There's a penalty for the act of murder. It's how our world works. But Jesus goes even farther. And he deals with the attitude that leads to the act of murder. You see, the law deals with action. But God deals with intention. He deals with the heart. He deals with the motivation. Notice verse 22, but I say to you, that anyone who's angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, you fool, or maybe your version says, raka, will be liable to the hell of fire. Just like Jesus isn't talking about all universal killing, he's not talking about all instances of anger. You know, there are righteous reasons to be angry. Righteous indignation, in other words. It's okay to be angry when there's injustice in the world. Something is that shouldn't be, and God has gave us this mechanism that identifies it. It's okay to be angry at sin. God is angry at sin. It's okay to be angry at persecution and prejudice. You know, Jesus was angry when they made a mockery of the temple. You remember that. He walked in one day, and he saw the scribes and the Pharisees and all the temple officials, and they had all these money-changing tables out there, and they were selling all these animals for sacrifice. And he says, you've made my father's house into a den of thieves. What they were doing was they were telling people, the law says you have to sacrifice a lamb here. And we're in charge of here. We're in charge of the temple. We tell you what lamb is worthy of being sacrificed. And we're going to tell you the only one you can sacrifice is the one we're going to sell you. And we're going to jack up the price so high you can't afford it. That's what they were doing. They weren't selling books. They weren't selling shirts. It wasn't that. It was extortion. And Jesus saw that and he got angry. And he created a whip out of cords. And you could just imagine him braiding these things, just looking around, braiding these things, and then erupting in this fit of anger and driving everyone out. This isn't talking about righteous anger. It's not talking even about losing your temper that one time when you woke up and the dog had messed on the carpet. It's not that kind. Or when you walked outside and there was a flat tire and you just lost your temper in the moment. That's not what this is either. This literally in Greek means a settled, fixed attitude of the heart. It's not the act of a person. It's not the heat of the moment necessarily. It's the way of thinking and the way of feeling toward another individual. And even then, notice he's not talking about just any attitude. He says here, whoever says to your brother, you fool, or in some versions it says raka, which is the original Hebrew word. He says, if you say raka to your brother, that you will be liable to the hell of fire. Now, maybe you're thinking, oh, I thought you were talking about me. I've never said raka to anybody. It's not like you're driving down the road and someone cuts you off and you're like, ah, you raka. We don't talk like that. But the attitude is there. Raka literally means, it says sometimes you fool. It's not the best transliteration. The fact that some versions say raka in the Bible is because there isn't really a Hebrew or an English equivalent to the Hebrew word, but it actually means you idiot, you empty-headed moron. It's a way of talking about a person and implying or meaning or believing in your heart that they're not worth the air they breathe, that the world would be better off if they weren't in it. You know, we hear a modern version of this, of raka in our English. It's when somebody takes someone's name and they wish that God would damn that person to hell. That's a way of saying raka in English. It's an attitude of the heart toward an individual wishing that they were not there. It's an attitude of hatred toward one of God's creation, made in his image, and therefore an attack on the Creator himself. It's the way Hitler viewed the Jews as a group of people who should not exist. It's another way of describing hate. And Jesus says that kind of anger, that type of hatred, that attitude of the heart is nothing more than a murder that hasn't happened in life yet. But if left to its own devices, if allowed to go unchecked, if allowed to go uncontrolled, it will. Now, you might hear that and think, I don't think so. I can be angry at somebody and I can control my emotions. I can control my passions. You might be able to. The average person can't. And it was proven that without the restraint of law, without the fear of the consequence, with the opportunity available, the average person would give in to this kind of thing. In 2017, it actually happened. In Brazil, all the cops went on strike that year. And within 3 days of them being gone, no arrests, no police car, no nothing, their murder rate went up 650% inside 3 days because they wouldn't get caught. Moses was a man the Jews worshiped. He gave us the first 5 books of the Bible. He was the man that God chose to lead Israel out of Egypt. And Moses, when he thought he wouldn't be caught, killed an Egyptian soldier. David, a man after God's own heart. It was David's line that would lead to Jesus Christ. It was David who God said, no one will sit on the throne of Israel if they don't come from you. David, when he didn't think he would be caught, killed the husband of Bathsheba, a man named Uriah, sent him back to the front lines to get him out of the way, put him there in a way that he knew he would die, and he did. Cain lured his brother out into a field where no one else was, and when no one was looking, killed him as well. And that's because it was an unrestrained, unchecked, uncontrolled heart of anger. It's what happens when that attitude develops. Jesus tells us here, but I say to you, anyone who is angry with his brother, who hates his brother, will be liable for these kinds of things. And so that's the attitude. The act comes from the attitude. But what do we do about the attitude that leads to the act? Well, Jesus talks about that too. He says, you need to be in full accord with one another. So we have the attitude, we have the act. He calls us to be in accord. You know, Paul says the same thing in Philippians 2. Be like-minded, of the same love, in full accord, and of one mind. Make sure the relationships, in other words, are not a breeding ground for bitterness. Notice what Jesus says in verse 23. So if you're offering your gift at the altar, and you remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before that altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Even if you're in the service of the Lord, and you realize your brother has something against you, go and fix the issue. You ever noticed how an unresolved problem in a relationship is kind of like kindling in a wilderness forest? In a forest, it's filled with all this dry brush, and you know how one spark, one match, one lightning strike, and the whole thing can be ablaze. Well, unresolved issues in relationships are that. If left unresolved, they become kindling. And one wrong word, one misstep, one misunderstanding, and all of a sudden, everything's on fire. You know, in James chapter 3, it says, how great a forest is set ablaze by such a small fire. And the tongue is a fire, setting on fire the whole course of life. And it doesn't help if that course of life, if that landscape is little more than a tinderbox of unresolved issues. Because one thing gets said, and then what happens? Oh yeah, well remember that time you did, and I never brought this up, but I'm gonna now, and all of the sudden, all these issues come to surface. And so what do we do about that? Well, Jesus says to be in full accord, to be of one accord. If you know that this happens, even if it comes to your mind and you're in the middle of doing something, you need to take whatever actions you need to take to leave that, to fix the issue, and to come back. Don't let it go unresolved. It will do nothing more than fester, and it will turn into resentment and anger and hatred. And hatred, Jesus says, is murder in the heart. You know, I was reading that over the past 50 years, the forest fires in the west coast of America, you know, California, Oregon, Washington, they've actually gotten markedly worse over the past 50 years. There was a lot of theories on it. Some people said climate change. Other people said it was, you know, because we're all driving gas engines. But nobody really knew until the most recent and most reputable theory being accepted right now is actually because of the increase of construction going on in those areas, the neighborhoods expanding into the woods, more fire hydrants and more fire trucks and more fire suppression has gone out there so that whenever there is a small ignition somewhere, they're able to put it out very quickly. The problem with that is forests will naturally burn from time to time. That's why the redwoods have fireproof bark. They're designed to withstand this, and the forest will cleanse itself in a way when fire comes through and removes all the brush. Well, if every time a little spark ignites and they're dousing it with water, nothing is cleaning out the brush, and nothing's cleansing all of this debris. And so when it finally does erupt one day, it's much worse than it ever would have been. The point is, don't let your relationships accumulate all the debris that leads to a major blaze. Deal with the issues. Confront the problems when they come. You can't ignore them. In Ephesians 4, it says, don't let the sun go down on your anger. And notice what else Jesus says. Notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, if you've done something wrong, go to your brother. He doesn't say, if you're angry with your brother. He doesn't say that. He says what? If you remember that your brother has something against you. If they're mad at you, he says, it's our responsibility to go and to fix it. You see, here's the thing. Peace in a relationship, the potential for murder in the heart, are too serious of issues to be worrying about who's going to say sorry first. Our kids do that all the time. You know, they'll be fighting for whatever reason, and it really doesn't matter. They'll fight over anything. They'll fight over who gets the toy. They'll fight over who doesn't get the toy. They'll fight over a toy they're not even playing with. They'll fight because someone's sitting in the spot that they were thinking about sitting in. I mean, you name it, they fight. And they all start the fights. But at any given time, one of them has started the fight in some way. And now they're at each other's throat. And we're saying, well, you need to apologize. Well, I didn't do it. They need to say sorry first. Well, I didn't do it. He did it. He needs to say sorry first. And then we step in and we say, we're the parents. I don't care who started it. We're ending it. You both apologize together. Don't become like that in your relationships. Doesn't matter who's at fault. Take the initiative. Restore the relationship. Jesus tells us in Matthew 5, blessed are the peacemakers in the world. Do what is needed to come to full accord, to restore the relationship. If your brother has something against you, go and be reconciled, he says, and then you can come back and keep going. Even if you're not at fault, even if you haven't done anything to deserve it, if there's a rift, we need to do what we can to make peace. You know, Paul says in Romans 12, so far as you are able to live peaceably with all. Now, I say that, and I know a lot of people are hearing as you are able. You know, sometimes I'm not able. They won't listen. They won't comply. They won't be reasonable. Interesting, it does say that, but you know what else it says? So far as you are able. So far as I am able, it's my job, not someone else's job. It's my job to go and try to restore the relationship, to take the initiative. Because if you don't, the relationship will be bitter and it will eventually turn into murder in the heart. I remember when we were moving from Albuquerque to Ohio and we didn't have a house to move to, but there was one on the sheriff's auction website that we said, well, we really like that house, but we can't buy it because with an auction, you have to go and pay cash and that kind of thing. And so we're just going to let it go. But then one of our relatives said, well, you know what? I have the cash in the bank. I'll buy the house and you can buy it from me with a mortgage. You move into it, get settled. A few months later, we'll get a mortgage. You buy the house from me and you buy it from me for whatever I paid. And so we said, okay. And we did it. And we moved into the home, and we realized very quickly the home needed some work. It had been kind of damaged from the previous owners as they're moving out, you know, punching holes in the wall and things. And so we started fixing it, and we started repairing it. But lo and behold, the relative who we'd done this deal with was making purchases for this house, things that we never agreed to, that we weren't aware of, but they just started stacking up and thousands of dollars of purchases to this home. So when we got to the settlement table and we gave a check for the price of the home purchase, and it didn't include all this other stuff that we didn't realize we were on the hook for, it created a rift. I would love to tell you that I was the bigger person, but in reality, I dug in my heels. And I said, I don't owe you that money. You chose to do that. You didn't talk to us. That wasn't anything we discussed together. I never would have spent that money. And you did it. That's on you. And meanwhile, they dug in their heels. And she said, no, you do owe me the money. This is what the house needed. And you agreed to pay for the house. And I said, I did agree to pay for the house. And I did. And we were both in our minds very right. And neither one of us would budge. And a relationship that we had for basically my entire life was now broken. And rather than mending it, it stayed that way. And eventually this relative died and that relationship was never fixed. That's not something that we want to live with. And so regardless of whose fault it is, Jesus said, if they have something against you, stop what you're doing and fix it. Be of one accord. Sometimes it's not your fault. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it is our fault. Sometimes we're the offender. Sometimes we're the transgressor. Whether we know it or not, sometimes it's what we've done that's caused this issue. And in those cases, Jesus says, it's not enough to just be in one accord. You've got to be accountable. And notice how he concludes this segment. Verse 25, come to terms quickly with your accuser. So you've gone from a brother that has something against you, a relative, another member of the church, a believer, somebody you're close with, to an accuser, somebody you have offended. He says, come to terms quickly with your accuser while you're going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard and you be put in prison. Truly, I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. Here's the thing about unresolved issues. They don't get better with time. Some things do. Some cheese gets better with time. Not the cheese in our house. That gets really gnarly with time. But some of the good stuff, you know. Some wines get better with time. Character can get better with time. Wisdom gets better with time. Problems don't get better with time. You know, they say that time heals all wounds. That's not really true. It'll put a Band-Aid over them, but eventually that Band-Aid will get ripped off and you're right back to where you were. Our issues in life will not go away because we ignore them. That nice little letter you got in the mail from the IRS, they're not going away. That traffic ticket's not going away. That neighbor you don't get along with, they're not just going to move one day because you don't like them anymore. These things aren't going to get easier. The boss isn't going to get easier. The problems in life aren't going to get easier. None of it will go away by ignoring it. And so Jesus says, come to terms quickly with your accuser, because it's only going to get worse. You know, it used to be that you could be put into debtor's prison. And if you didn't pay your bill, it's not like they cared about your credit. You couldn't go bankrupt. They wouldn't just garnish your wages. No, they would come, handcuff you, and lock you up in some kind of a workhouse where you would pay your literal debt to society. We don't have that kind of stuff anymore now, but we do have a figurative prison. And there's a lot of people in that. It's a prison of regret and anger and fear. When there's an accuser, when there's someone against you and it's unresolved, it's always the wonder, it's the fear of what are they going to do next? What are they going to say next? What other problems are they going to cause next? You know, they're living rent-free in your home, in your head, in your heart, and they're causing all of these issues. They have imprisoned you. There's not much to do in a prison like that, except to think and think about why you're there. And you know, it's pretty hard to be pure of heart, to be merciful, to want to make a relationship better if all you're doing is thinking about the person who put you in the jail. We send our kids to their room sometimes and we say, now think about what you've done. In some cases, it's good to contemplate that, but there's people who live in that because they haven't dealt with the problem, which leads to anger, which leads to hatred, which leads to murder in the heart. When I was a cop, I worked a stint in the jail. And there were people in there, and some of them were accountable for their actions. But the vast majority of people in the prison population are stewing about who put them there, who ratted on them, who testified against them, what happened. And you don't know how many people told me, when I get out of here, I can't wait to talk to that person again. I can't wait to run into them on the street. I can't wait to visit their home. And they sat there and stewed about the wrong that they had been done in their mind. And there's a lot of people who live there relationally. Somebody has something against them, and rather than dealing with it, they just sit and stew. And Jesus says, don't do that. Come to terms quickly with your accuser. Even at the courtroom steps, it's never too late to go and deal with this problem. Because the only way out of this kind of prison is to be accountable for the action, to move on with your life. You know, it's very hard for the enemy to imprison you with something you've already moved on from. You know, there's a story of a man who dies and he goes and he's before the throne of God and he's standing there and Satan comes up and says, you know, you're not going to want this guy. He's a liar. He's a murderer. He's a cheat. He lied on his taxes. He wasn't, you know, honest all the time with his wife. You should see how many times he clocked in early and stayed late and didn't work or took an early lunch. And so to see all those times he was speeding because there was no cop around, or, you know, all those times he took what didn't belong to him, or the time he put up a fence and he put it a foot over his neighbor's property because it was more convenient and he just thought it would add a little bit. You don't want this guy in your heaven. And the guy looks at God and says, everything he said is right. But by God's grace, by the blood of Christ, I have been forgiven. It's an awful hard thing to imprison you with something you've already dealt with. And so Jesus says, come to terms quickly with your accuser. Don't live in that kind of jail. Do you have a turbulent heart right now? Do you have forgiveness that you need to give or offer or ask of something? Is there a relationship you need to mend? Issues you've got to deal with somewhere? Are you bitter towards something? Are you angry at something? Someone? Circumstance, whatever it might be. I want to encourage you to make peace with that person. I want to encourage you to calm a turbulent heart. Jesus says you will never get out of prison until you've paid the last penny. And so come to terms quickly. If you know someone has something against you, go to them.